This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. How much warmer can the Earth get before there are serious consequences? That's a question that scientists have been debating, and a topic that Western Michigan University professor of biological sciences David Corot plans to tackle as part of the Lyceum Lecture Series. His address is called What's at Risk? 2 degrees versus 4 degrees warming. David Corot, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about those two numbers. What's the significance, 2 degrees and 4 degrees?
4 degrees, really a little bit above 4 degrees, is the likely increase in global average temperature by the end of the century, 2100, if we continue on our current path.
4 degrees Celsius?
4 degrees Celsius, so 7-8 degrees Fahrenheit. The warming would be more than that in high latitudes, a little bit less than that in the tropics, more than that over land, less than that over the oceans, but on average about 4-4.5 degrees. If we don't make major changes in where we get our energy from, 2 degrees is sort of a compromise between what the scientific community thinks we should do and what the scientific community thinks we have a chance to do. 2 degree warming would be the result of shifting over fairly quickly and fairly extensively to alternate energy sources, non-carbon-based energy sources. And it corresponds to how much Earth would warm if we, by mid-century, got about 80% of our energy from non-fossil fuel sources.
And again, we're talking 2 degrees Celsius, so right. More like 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that?
Right, exactly. Yep. Doesn't sound like much, but as a change in global average temperature, it's huge.
You mentioned there the idea that scientists would prefer something else. I mean, would scientists just prefer that we not warm at all?
Sure. Yeah. I think without question, the best alternative is to not allow Earth to warm. But that would require either major changes in energy infrastructure at a very rapid pace, which I think is possible. It's just not something that we're, as a species, entertaining as a reasonable possibility now. Or it would require manipulating the climate in some other way. We don't have good ways to do that yet. We have ways in which, in theory, we could cool the planet, for instance, putting reflective surfaces high in the atmosphere or on the ocean, essentially mirrors that would bounce sunlight back out to space before the surface of the Earth could convert it into heat. But those are highly theoretical at this point. There's nothing that we are close to being able to implement.
When we talk about this 2 degrees or 4 degrees warming, what's our base point here? Where are we starting from? Are we starting from now, or are we starting from a ways back and saying that, you know, the temperature has warmed and it would warm more to get to this 2 degree point?
That's a really good question. It depends which paper you are reading. Most of the recent papers use as their baseline the average temperature of the Earth from 1980 to 2000. So essentially warming from now. In 1980, Earth was about 7/10 of a degree Celsius warmer than before the Industrial Revolution. So it doesn't make too much difference. What you use as your starting point is about 7/10 of a degree difference.
So what is the risk if the Earth does get 2 degrees warmer? What are we looking at in terms of changes that we might face as people, as a human species?
Right. The way I'm going to talk about this subject on Wednesday, I'm going to actually try to take a relatively optimistic or hopeful viewpoint. And what I'm going to do is talk first about what our current pathway, what consequences there will be of our current pathway for 4.5 degrees, and then talk about how what we would gain by limiting warming to 2 degrees. A necessary conclusion is that 2 degrees is not without adverse consequences. I mean, there are problems with 2 degrees, but there are way more problems with 4-4.5 degrees. For instance, if we allow Earth to warm as we are currently doing, so that it reaches 4 degrees by the end of the century, that will likely result in about 400 million more people at risk of getting malaria, mostly in Africa, although some actually in the southern United States. If we limit warming to 2 degrees, we cut that number in half. So one of the ways to look at the benefits of shifting over to alternate energy sources is that we prevent potentially 200 million cases of malaria a year. Another way to look at it is that heat waves, of course, would be less frequent, less intense, less, they would have be of shorter duration, and as a consequence, less lethal. So, for instance, a prediction is that with 4.5 degree warming, Boston is likely to have about 1,100 deaths per year due to heat waves. If we keep warming to 2 degrees, that's less than 400 per year. So we save over 700 people a year just in Boston alone. And those are, I think, important ways to look at the benefits of the choice we have. The choice we have is, do we continue to use fossil fuels the way we have, or roughly the way we have, or do we make a very concerted effort to shift over to safer, really saner energy sources? And the focus has largely been on the cost of shifting from, you know, business as usual to a different lifestyle, different source of energy. I think the emphasis should be more so on the benefits of doing that. And that's what I'll try to present on Wednesday. And we can measure those benefits in all kinds of ways. It's relatively easy to measure it in terms of benefits to human health. For instance, reduced deaths due to heat stress, reduced malaria. There are other human health benefits that are harder to quantify. I think the probability of armed conflict is much greater if we allow Earth to warm 4 degrees than 2 degrees. It's hard to quantify exactly what it is.
Well, why do you think that? What's the theory behind that?
Because 4 degree warming results in much more frequent, severe, prolonged droughts, which cause crop failures. And in much of the world where subsistence agriculture is the way of life, crop failures mean that it's very difficult to survive. And those kinds of stresses on human societies almost certainly will result in some increased level of armed conflict. Resources become much scarcer. So if you don't have them, but your neighbor does, you have little choice but to try to use force to gain them. That's the idea anyway. And the climate-related events that precipitate conflict would be much reduced at 2 degree than relative to 4 degree. And then there are other consequences, for instance, for ecosystems. I mean, it's very hard to make a global prediction about extinctions, but our best estimate at this point is that if we allow Earth to warm about 4 degrees, we probably will lose close to 40% of all species on the planet. If we keep warming to 2 degrees, it's more like 10% of species. So you can think of shifting from coal to solar and wind to generate electricity helps us save 30% of Earth species from extinction. It's a very rough estimate, but it's likely to be somewhere in that ballpark.
There have been a number of articles. There was a study from researchers at the University of California, San Diego, saying that it's really probably past the point that we can limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius over the next however many number of years you want to pick, that we're going to go past that. What do you say to that? Do you think that it is difficult?
Oh, it's difficult. But it really requires a concerted global effort. It can't be done by one country. It has to be done by an international coalition, especially of the major carbon emitters, which are Europe, China, United States, India. But the developing countries are emitting now a substantial portion of carbon, so they have to be involved too. But we have the technologies to stop using almost all fossil fuels quite quickly if we wanted to. It just would, we see it as disruptive and therefore undesirable to do that. But if we had no choice, if we knew without a doubt, for instance, that our planet would be irreparably changed such that it was not suitable for human habitation, if we didn't do something within 10 years, if we didn't stop using fossil fuels within 10 years, what would we say? Would we say, well, we can't do that, so I guess our planet is gone? Or would we say, we'll do it in 5 years? And I think we would say we'll do it in 5. We know that we have the capacity. We just don't have the will to do it yet. Coal is the easiest fossil fuel to abandon, to replace. We have other ways of generating electricity, solar and wind, that actually, if you include the health costs of using coal, these alternate energy sources for electricity turn out to be less expensive per kilowatt hour. So we have technologies that are even economically feasible.
Well, the question, though, is often raised, are these technologies able to produce as much energy as we produce right now?
Right. Yeah, one of the falsehoods that is quite common is that, for instance, wind and solar are either incapable of producing the amount of electricity we want or incapable of producing a consistent, reliable stream of electricity. Both of those.
Because, for instance, there are days when we don't see the sun. Sure. So are we able to get energy on a day when it's very overcast and not much sunlight's available?
Right. It's an argument that on the surface sounds reasonable, but it's not. Solar energy. So all you really need is some way of storing energy while you're making it in excess of what you're using at that point, and then being able to tap that when you're not making it currently. So with solar, not photovoltaics, but the solar thermal techniques, so the kinds that are used in big utility scale solar farms, for instance, in our Southwest, basically differ from a coal-fired power plant only in where the heat is coming from to make steam. Okay, both of them generate steam. The expansion of steam drives turbines that generates electricity. In a coal-fired power plant, we get the heat from burning coal, and as a consequence, put a lot of carbon into the air and other particulate matter and so on that harms people downwind. In a solar thermal utility scale installation, we just use the sun to make the heat. You focus the sun's rays on a material that can heat up to, let's say, 1200 degrees Celsius, and you use that heat to make steam. And from that point on, it's the same as a coal-fired power plant. You use the steam to drive a turbine that generates electricity. So on sunny days, for instance, in the Southwest, those installations can make so much heat that they can't possibly use all the electricity they could generate at the moment. All that's required is a heat reservoir, for instance, buried in the sand right next to the tower, that can store excess heat during the day, and then all night long you can make steam, and if you can make steam, you can make electricity. So it's a very simple fix. And people who spread the argument that solar is no good because can never be our sole source of electricity because it's an intermittent source, actually know that that's not true. So it's an intentional deception.
Does the same thing apply to wind?
Yes.
Where there are days when the air is calm and we don't have any wind to speak of?
Right. So with wind, first of all, the wind is much more, it's stronger and more consistent the higher you go. So U.S. turbines are actually the most efficient of any countries, mainly because we can put them up higher. We do put them up higher than China or even Denmark and so on. So first of all, you can put your turbine where intermittent wind is not as much of an issue. But more to the point, during windy times, the wind is allowing you to generate more electricity than there's demand for at the time. And a very simple fix is to use that extra energy simply to pump water uphill. You can pump it up into a reservoir, and then when the wind dies down, you simply let the water run downhill. You have a hydroelectric plant at the bottom of the reservoir. And in fact, we're doing that in Michigan. There is what's called a pumped storage plant in Ludington. So wind and solar are capable of producing electricity 24/7, 365. They're also capable of producing vastly more electricity than we currently use. Estimates for potential for solar-generated electricity are usually between 50 and 100 times total global use. Wind is usually 20 to 40 times total global use. And in the United States, we could produce at least 20 times as much electricity as we use just by wind alone. And we could produce more than that just by solar alone. So they're perfectly viable technologies. They are economically viable also, if you take into account the true cost of coal. And we don't have to invent anything new. We have these technologies available. We simply have not demonstrated the will to implement them. And I think looking at the benefits of implementing them, what we gain by limiting warming to 2 degrees, for instance, relative to 4 degrees, can help people realize how important it is to shift over as quickly as possible.
I don't want to turn this into the whole debate of, you know, deniers versus the climate science, but it is known that there have been fluctuations in the Earth's temperature for a long time, since the beginning of when the Earth was in existence.
Sure.
So I guess I'm wondering, how much can we isolate the extent to which we as humans are contributing to it, and the extent to which we as humans can do something to correct it?
Sure. Two great questions. So Earth's temperature has always fluctuated. Climate's not been constant for very long. We know that, for instance, 12,000 years ago, Kalamazoo was under more than half a mile of ice. That, by the way, when that was true, Earth's temperature was 5 degrees cooler, 5 degrees C cooler. So it gives you an idea of what a 4 to 5 degree change in the opposite direction might do. But to get to your point, Earth's temperature has been changing all the time. And we know why. Because of cyclic alterations in Earth's, the shape of Earth's orbit, the extent of Earth's tilt, and where Earth's is in its orbit when the northern summer occurs. Those three things determine the intensity of sunlight reaching our planet. So for instance, when Earth's orbit is more elliptical, less circular, we spend more time away from the sun, we get less energy from the sun, and Earth cools. Those three things change on cycles that are 100,000 years, 40,000, and 20,000 years. Much, much too slow. Slowly to account for anything close to the magnitude of warming we're seeing now. More importantly, we have been able to measure very accurately what the total amount of energy from the sun coming into Earth has been since the late 70s, when we had satellites that could measure it outside of the lower parts of Earth's atmosphere. And in order for natural factors to have accounted, the increased solar radiation is the only natural factor that could have any chance of causing warming anything close to what we have seen. But it would have to have been increasing very dramatically. And what we can tell, what we can measure directly, is that since the late 70s, while Earth has been warming the fastest, the amount of solar radiation reaching the planet has been decreasing. So there is no plausible mechanism by which natural factors could account for Earth's warming. In contrast, if you calculate the heat trapping capacity of various greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, chlorofluorocarbons, nitrous oxide, that we have been putting into the atmosphere, and use that very simple physics to predict how much warming should have occurred on our planet, it is very close to the amount of warming we've seen. So we have one mechanism that makes sense and is validated by measurements. We have another that has been ruled out by measurements. And the bottom line is that it's very clear that humans are responsible for the vast majority, if not all, of warming in the last several decades.
And therefore, if we change what humans do, that should address the warming trend in some way, significant way.
Yes. So we have caused it, and we can reverse it. We simply have to stop doing what we've been doing to cause it. But we have to do that quickly in order to prevent serious adverse consequences for humans and basically all species on the planet.
So if we do go past this 2 degrees Celsius threshold, or even worse, go past the 4 degrees Celsius threshold, are there ways to reverse that and bring the temperatures back down?
In theory, yes. So they fall into a category called geoengineering solutions. And the The most promising, although it's still nowhere near close to even being demonstrated on a small scale, but still the most promising category is manipulating the solar budget of the Earth. So basically taking the only natural factor that we know has been responsible for Earth's climate changes in the past and manipulating it, basically bouncing sunlight back to space before it can hit a surface and heat up that surface. You know, sunlight, sun energy, light energy gets converted into heat energy when it hits a surface. That's why we sunbathe. And so in theory, we could reflect some of it back, but we have no idea what the consequences would be of putting mirrors in space or small, very small reflective particles in the stratosphere or ionosphere or wherever. I think, has to be seen as a very last-ditch attempt to rescue the planet. We have better ways to do it. And we can create jobs, we can clean up our air, we can save lives, we can make Earth a better place in many ways, in addition to keeping the climate from getting, from changing so much that the planet becomes very difficult to inhabit.
David Corot, thank you very much for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
David Corot is a professor of biological sciences at Western Michigan University. You can find details of his address called What's at Risk? 2 degrees versus 4 degrees warming, which will be presented Wednesday at noon as part of the Lyceum Lecture Series at Western. You can find those details at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.